Welcome to RJI's podcast series, hosted by Lisa Ray. Restorative Justice International is an association and network with over 5,700 members and affiliates. In this podcast series, Lisa interviews leaders in the restorative justice field from around the globe, as well as speaking to crime victims and ex-offenders who have participated in restorative justice themselves. The podcast series will allow you to hear from key thought leaders about issues related to crime and justice from a restorative justice perspective. Now, here's Lisa Ray.
Today's podcast is with Margaret Thorsborn from Australia. She's the managing director of Margaret Thorsborn and Associates. Margaret, with a strong background in education, counseling, and project management, has highly developed skills as a facilitator, trainer, and presenter. She's widely recognized as an international expert on school and workplace bullying and has played a major role in the introduction of restorative practices into schools and workplaces in Australia and internationally. She's presented papers and workshops and conducted training across Australia, New Zealand, Asia, Canada, UK, and the USA. Welcome, Margaret.
Thank you, Lisa.
Great to have you. Great to have you.
It's lovely to be speaking with you, and I imagine it's very cold there.
It is.
And it's very hot here.
Exactly. And the question I always ask our guests is, how did we meet?
I think we met online. So I came across RJI, and it just made perfect sense for me to hook up. And I think probably from there, we made a connection, and I joined the organization as an associate or...
Yeah, an affiliate.
Yeah. Yes, affiliate, yes.
That's right. Yeah. That's exactly right. That's my recollection as well. And we really appreciate that because you were an early supporter of RJI. And also, I know that we have a connection through Martin Howard, who is there in Queensland.
Yes, Martin is a great colleague and friend of mine. He's on the Queensland Committee of Restorative Practices International, which is RPI, and we have a Queensland chapter.
Yes.
And we do local work. Yes. So
yes.
Fantastic.
Yes.
Hmm.
Well, he highly regards you, and I know that you're a champion to so many in Australia and really around the world. So let's just dig in here. How did you first get into this work of restorative justice and why?
A colleague, Mary Hindman, and I were both working as school counsellors in the Queensland Education Department, and we were tasked with a job to develop a whole school approach to bullying, actually. So sort of an anti-bullying kind, not so much a program, but a series of interventions. And while we thought we could handle the very low-level stuff that would have amounted to mild teasing, which was getting uncomfortable and possibly even sort of mediumly serious bullying that a circle of friends type approach could handle, we were stumped about what to do about really serious stuff, because what the research was showing was that if you punish perpetrators of bullying, then you make it far worse for the victims. Mm. So when we discovered what the police in New South Wales had been experimenting with as a sort of restorative caution process to keep young people out of the criminal justice system, we were very excited because it seemed to fit the bill around accountability.
Yes.
And an exploration of the harm that had been done rather than focusing on how these young people should be punished. So it was bullying actually that led us to this process, which of course was adapted from the work across the ditch in New Zealand called the Family Group Conference Process.
Yes.
Yes. So that's what got us excited. And, of course, while the original pursuit was because of bullying, what we discovered was that it was a perfect response to anything pretty much that was serious that kids got up to in schools that would result in them being suspended or turfed out.
Right, right. And so what would the process look like when you have a bully and a victim of bullying? What does it look like?
Well, I think, first of all, you know, the usual investigation has to happen so that we're clear about the facts. And then, of course, we have to ask and prepare people for the process. So you can't force people into this process. So we make a case about how people are going to find their needs being met during this process. And then, depending on the seriousness, but of course we started at what I would call a pointy end, and that what that meant is that you bring the people together who are responsible and their families, and the people harmed and their families, plus the officials in the school that had to deal with the issues, and you just work through a restorative conference process, which begins with the perpetrators of the bullying, the young people responsible talking about what they've been doing, talking about their motivations for doing it, what they might imagine it might be like for the other parties, and then we engage with the young people who've been bullied, their families, the schools who've the school officials who've dealt with it, and finally with the parents or family members of the young people who've attended. And that's an extraordinary unfolding of all sorts of things when people begin to share their stories about it. So while it was built around the principles of the criminal justice system, you know, the application in schools has been absolutely extraordinary.
Yes, yes. And I'm aware, Margaret, that you have your own story to tell about being bullied.
I have indeed, but, you know, I'm really happy to share this. I was at boarding school for my high school years because the little country town that I was raised in didn't have a high school that went right through to graduation. So Mum and Dad sent me off to boarding school, and I was delighted to do it, and I was very, very happy until in about year 10, I suppose, when I would have been around 14 or 15, there was another girl in the class who was very, very charismatic, and she must have decided for some reason that I needed to be managed or controlled or put down or dominated or whatever, and she made my life absolute hell. And I think I was so naive in those days that I didn't even twig that what was happening to me was bullying. But I certainly remember the feelings of complete isolation and my fear of running into her or being around her in any way, even in public, because she could contrive to do what she did publicly anyway. But my friends didn't stick up for me. And there was no one for me to tell the story to because one just didn't back in those days. So what happened to me as a result of that is that the scars of that were deep and very long-lasting. And I think that had, you know, restorative process been available to me and the school that... that young girl and me as a young girl could have sorted some stuff out that wouldn't have left such deep scar tissue, which even now, you know, when I'm in the throes of late middle age, still bubble to the surface every now and then, despite my best efforts to, you know, I mean, intellectually, of course, I've reconciled everything that's happened, but it's yucky stuff. And I'm very lucky that I didn't, that it didn't scar me so badly that I had to take serious matters into my own hands, either doing away with myself or doing away with her.
And so at the time, especially given what you do, the kind of work you do now in restorative justice, what would you have wanted the bully to say to you? What would you have wanted from her?
Well, I think probably what I would have wanted more than anything is to understand why she was doing it to me, what all of that was about. you know, because it just didn't make sense. I mean, I was hardworking and earnest, and I got really good results for my work, and she was probably more mediocre in terms of academic prowess. Maybe that's what it was all about. Maybe I'd offended her in some way, but, you know, I'll never know, really. And that's what I wanted to know, and I wanted to know why. Because if I knew why, looking back on it now, I would have known that it wasn't about me at all.
Right. And I assume you would have wanted the person to take responsibility.
And, oh, yes, absolutely. Yes. And to pull her head in and stop it, really. Right. Because my life was miserable, you know, for a long period of time there at boarding school. And there's no escape when you're, you know, locked up. Really, with a bunch of other girls. It was a girls' boarding school.
Yes.
So girls can be so horrible to each other.
Yes, and when you're talking about the work that you do through Margaret Thorsborn and Associates and the others that work with you at your firm, what kind of cases do you take on? I mean, in the schools, are they considered nonviolent cases?
Oh no. Oh, look, there's a whole range of work that we do. I mean, the most of my efforts these days are in training school people to handle the serious stuff themselves. But occasionally I do get called into a school to deal with situations where the school is regarded as no longer neutral, so that even though there would be a skilled person in the school who could facilitate something for serious matters, you know, the parents of both families are probably cranky with the school at this stage because they haven't been able to solve the problem. So, yes, there are all sorts of interesting matters that happen, not just around bullying, but certainly with violence.
Yes, and how about sexual offending?
Well, the sexual offending, you have to be very careful around the risk management issues and whether or not it's a matter that is a care and protection matter and belongs in another agency, or is it a police matter and belongs in another agency, because we can't be, in a school, you can't be meddling with, you know, other agency processes. But there's a lot that happens in schools that's just ugly that, you know, if you were anal about it, you would declare it as a criminal matter or a care and protection matter. But if it's low level and the parties are willing to speak about it, then I think we get sometimes a wee bit tied up on the word sexual instead of just thinking about harassment or just plain ugly behaviour towards each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I can remember a case. Not one that I dealt with, but a colleague of mine did, where some senior boys in a school started what they called the rating game. And so they put it's a group of boys, I don't know, maybe 8 or 10 of them. They put a whole pile of girls' names in a hat, and they had to pick out the name of a girl, and their job was to go and seduce her and then report back to the group about how she performed. So that one happily was nipped in the bud before anything actually occurred, but nevertheless extraordinarily confronting to bring those young men and their families together with the girls who agreed to participate and their families about what that game meant.
Yes. Yeah. And would you say that there's increased support for restorative justice in cases of bullying in particular throughout Australia, for one?
Well, I think there's a general increase in interest in restorative practice across most states in Australia, although, again, that's a little bit patchy because, like in the States, we have separate education departments. But what education departments are recognising now is that the continued and overuse of suspension as a tool to...
Yes.
Kind of cleanse the difficult child out of the school really disadvantages the disadvantaged, and with the school to prison pipeline.
Yes.
Schools really have to step up and do things differently. You know, where young people are emancipated these days, and they just don't do what they're told because we tell them to do it, unfortunately. And that would make life so much easier. But we have to do this work in schools through relationships, and we have to continue to develop kids' social and emotional competence so that when they do graduate and go off to their workplaces to become employees or employers or husbands or wives or mums or dads or neighbours or, you know, whatever, that they know how to live in right relationship with each other.
Right. And also, I always ask this of most of our guests, politically speaking, let's say, again, just in Australia, is there support politically for using restorative practices in the schools and education?
Again, Lisa, I think it depends on which party is in power. Mm-hmm. So I would have to say that the right-wing side of politics is still a kind of get tough, you know, get tough and boot people out and lock them up. So whether we're talking about youth justice or dealing with disciplinary matters in schools, it's, again, a sort of right-wing conservative view of things versus left-wing, more liberal view of things. So there have been some, very difficult cases, as there are everywhere in the world, where a school has followed its policy about something, but the policy has been woefully inadequate. So I think with a greater focus on student well-being and staff well-being, we're more likely to get more gains on the restorative practice front. But I've been at it now for, I think this marks, next year will mark the beginning of my 24th year working in this restorative patch with schools. Mm. And while the early experiments happened in Queensland back in the mid-90s, once the funding had dried up after, you know, a couple of years of experimentation, really, they just kind of went back to the way things were because, you know, systems and schools in particular are very resilient. You can stretch the elastic, but you take the pressure off and they'll snap back to the way they were. So I'm glad I'm in it for the long haul because yes. I'm finally experiencing an increased interest in restorative practice in my own state yes. across the government schools, although the private sector has always been more interested in this because usually the private sector is allied with some sort of, you know, religious faith affiliation, and the restorative values kind of meet and do well with the values of the faith that the school might be promoting.
Hmm. Yeah, and, you know, you said something interesting because it's something we talk about quite a bit at RJI. You know, we've found around the world that there's more support for restorative justice and restorative practices because it's victims-driven, and that is not seen politically as being something on the left politically, but actually something that those that are on the right politically support.
Yeah, look, I think there's still work to be done around the needs of victims here, certainly in Australia. But the right wing, the right wing side of politics, while they would say this is to support victims, they're doing it without actual victim voices.
Oh, yes.
So they're making assumptions about what victims need.
Yes.
And they don't also canvass the idea of how can a victim heal?
Yes.
As well as how can a person who's responsible for that harm heal? Because,
yes.
you know, the people who are incarcerated are the ones who've probably been deeply harmed themselves.
Yes.
Along the way. So it's just a kind of what is the quote from the Bible? Something about visiting the sins of the third and fourth generation or something.
Yes, yes. Well, I think you raise a really, really important point because politically it's so important to make sure that that those of us in the restorative justice movement, that we go to victims who have experienced restorative justice and who have a story to tell and then become advocates for restorative justice because it has promoted healing in their lives.
Yes, indeed. And I just remember in a previous state government that we had that the Attorney General was heard to say, and he was deeply conservative, a good person, but deeply conservative, I will not have victims in the same room as offenders. You know, so who is he to decide?
Right. Oh, yes. And that's actually a very foolish position, because if we're trying to change behavior of offenders, it's the offenders that need to meet those victims face to face, as we've learned.
Absolutely. And the sooner that we can do it in schools, the better.
Yes, in schools. And let's just segue into your work that you do in the workplace. So workplace harassment, what does that look like?
Oh, it just looks like what it looks like at school, but with older with older people,
yes.
Actually. But people's whole identity is tied up with how they are at work and how they feel at work and how they feel about the work. So unless you've got leadership and management that are acutely aware of what's happening and the state of relationships between people, they're either completely ignorant of it and ignore it, or if someone makes a complaint, they say, oh, just harden up and get over it, you know, because you just have to get used to that person. You know, they're always like that. So for me, that is a complete, it's either incredibly permissive or incredibly neglectful.
Yes, yes. Mm. And so you are often hired by corporations then to come in and present restorative practices, or do you train, or how does that work?
Well, I do both, actually. I am hired to facilitate, processes in situations where the management wants the problem solved but doesn't have the skill set to solve it around, you know, whatever the conflict or bullying or whatever might be. And then there's... you know, if the organisation is big enough and they're interested enough, then I provide the training for people in HR and management to have the kind of difficult accountability sort of conversations, so that they just become the norm, you know, rather than having to trot out an extraordinary process. Why not just keep the small things small and work on what makes a workplace work,
right,
rather than waiting for things to go wrong and being reactionary all the time.
Right. And obviously today, I mean, here it is December 2017, and we have sexual offending, sexual harassment, sexual abuse in the workplace around the world.
Absolutely.
So it seems like right now is a perfect time to be applying restorative justice and restorative practices, yes?
Absolutely. And I'm happy to report that a colleague of mine from some years ago, when he worked in a completely different setting, has contacted me some 15 years later to say, Marg, we've got an issue and I can't think of anyone else who's got a process that will be helpful.
Yes, yes. Oh, well, that's excellent. And I want to ask you, I'm kind of looking to the future. What do you think is in the future for restorative justice? I mean, what's new ground that we might see in the future in terms of its application?
Oh, Lisa, I think there are no limits, actually. You know, the whole world of conflict resolution and the whole piece about litigation, all of that could be moved. I think before the money, people are actually interested in being understood. And if you can sort the piece about this is what my need is to be understood about something, instead of ignoring that, then, you know, it's sort of directly proportional or indirectly proportional. The less understood I am, the more money I'm going to demand. Hmm. So there's that, the litigation piece, but, you know, we're seeing in every conference that I attend as a delegate or presenting a workshop or a keynote, I'm seeing more and more interesting work. I mean, people have just taken this idea about responsibility and accountability and what harm's been done and what can we do to minimise the harm and prevent it from happening in the future. Every time
yes.
I go to a conference, I see a new application.
Yes.
So that is extraordinarily exciting. And one project that we've just completed, although it's the beginning of a series of projects, is looking at how do we adapt restorative practice with people with special needs.
Mm.
So that's just one way of adapting the process. But there are the whole environmental piece. I remember at some stage in New Zealand, where I would do a great deal of work, there was in Auckland, there are...
Yes.
a series of volcanoes. They're old volcanoes, obviously. And on one of the volcanoes, and the hill is called One Tree Hill, it had one tree growing at the top of it. And some fellow went and chopped it down one night. And, you know, that was a landmark. It was a sacred place. And sensibly, the Kiwis, because they're deeply restorative in their approaches to problem solving in general, just held him accountable in a restorative process. I mean, that's just a very small environmental issue, but people's emotions are attached to the environment. So when trees are felled in forests, for example, that shouldn't have been felled, when there's land clearing that shouldn't be clearing, when the barrier reef is destroyed or looks like being destroyed because there's a new coal mine being proposed in central Queensland and the runoff is going to cause all sorts of issues, these are the spaces, I think, where restorative problem solving is going to produce the goods rather than very, very expensive court processes.
Yes, that's a wonderful application. And I actually remember being in Auckland at a restorative justice conference in 2004 where I met some environmentalists there, and we were talking about just this type of idea of applying restorative justice to environmental harm. So that's wonderful. Yeah. Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
Well, Margaret, we're coming to the end of the podcast, but I want you to give our listeners your website.
Well, that's www.thorsborn.com.au.
Well, wonderful, wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Margaret, for being with us today. It's been an honor talking to you.
It's been an absolute pleasure, and keep up the good work with RJI, Lisa. We need you.
Great. Thank you so much. And this is Lisa Ray for RJI.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the RJI podcast series with Lisa Ray. Stay in touch and support our work at restorativejusticeinternational.com.